before that, we have Loretta Ross. Loretta Ross is the founder and the national coordinator of Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, which has been renamed to the Reproductive Justice Collective. Is that right? Yeah. Composed of 70 women of color organizations. She was the co-director of the April 25th, 2004 National March for Women's Lives in Washington, D.C. She's also the co-author of Undivided Right, Women of Color Organizing for Reproductive Justice. Ross's areas of expertise are reproductive rights, human rights, women's issues, diversity issues, hate groups, and bias crimes. Her list of achievements in these areas is extensive. I really encourage you to take a look in your program for a more complete list because she's really wonderful. So welcome, Loretta. Thank you.
I hope y'all are doing well and enjoying this conference as much as I am. Aren't y'all having a good time? I have to say that a couple of really interesting things are happening for me today. First of all, I'm sparing you a PowerPoint. No PowerPoint. Could have done one, and then I said, no, I really needed to speak from my heart because so much has happened in this conference that keeps changing my speech. I went to the play last night, the Jane play. I mean, God, did that rock or what? And so then I had to give it, so then I went home last night and started working on yet another speech. And then I saw all the fabulous presentations this morning, including Jessica's presentation and all that. And I said, oh, damn, I got to do another speech. And then the film showed up with all of my best lines. So yet another speech. So here's a speech. Six lines of notes. But it was all good. And the other thing that's been interesting for me is that, you know, I do about 200 of these a year. So you can say I got a lot of frequent flyer miles. And a lot of times I just flit in and out of a conference and give my speech, hide out in my hotel room, go back home. This is probably the first conference in 10 years I was here from start to finish. And it's made me reevaluate how I tend to take our movement for granted. And so thank y'all for changing my life and helping me learn as much as I hope I have to offer. And so that's, I just need to share that with you because this is what's on top for me. And so don't really underestimate the power of what you're doing and even its impact, not on the millions of women that we're representing, but the millions of women that are in our movement who sometimes get a little burnt out or a little overwhelmed or a little tired or all of those things. And when you can transform the life of a woman who's been doing this work for 35 years, you've done something. And so take yourselves as seriously as I'm taking you. Now, always do the work with fun now. Taking the movement seriously doesn't mean that you do it without humor. A friend of mine who's a Nazi hunter, well, I have strange friends. I mean, I have Nazis who are friends, really. One of my trips to Canada was when I was doing anti-Klan, anti-fascist work, which y'all had a little problem up here. And one of my friends who's a Nazi hunter once said to me, when I was taking the work too seriously and not getting any sleep and agonizing over whether I was doing enough, he said, wait a moment, Loretta. Being a Nazi should suck. Fighting Nazis should be fun. And we can apply that to a number of situations. You know, being a person opposed to human rights should be the sucky position. You know, fighting for human rights should be the joyful position. And so remember, the work is wonderful, it's serious, the cause is perfect. So that means we don't have to be perfect because we have a perfect mission. Yeah. Keep that in mind. We have a lot of trouble trying to be like the, you know, the ultra warrior, hyper perfect, totally politically correct, absolutely boring person. Which not only is it not necessary, I'm not even sure if it's effective. Because we have to go out there and talk to a lot of people who do wonderfully important things to them that we would probably judge as politically incorrect. You know, we have to go out there and talk to people who like bloody contact sports, like football and soccer and stuff. I actually like that stuff myself. And so those are some of the transformative things that have happened for me this weekend. So I want to say thank y'all. Thank y'all for allowing me to be part of this. And thank y'all for presenting such a wonderful program, Jane, Simon, and all of you who organized this. And really don't underestimate its transformative impact, even on those, you know, they say you're always preaching to the choir. Well, often the choir ain't on the same page. And so that's really important. The other way my speech changed is that I'm going to tell a little bit more of my personal story than I had planned on doing. I didn't get into this movement intentionally. I actually had no political consciousness as a child. I came from solidly conservative black family. My father was a Jamaican immigrant in the military trying to be uber American. You know how it goes, the immigrants to overly assimilate. Yeah, that was my dad. My mother, he was a member of the National Rifle Association, proud of it. My mother's both my parents have passed, was a staunch Christian, Southern Christian, who didn't believe in women wearing pants, smoking, dating, cursing, which was kind of funny because my mother died of Alzheimer's, and at the end of her life, she started cursing up a storm. And I'm totally convinced this was all pent-up stuff that she'd wanted to say all of her life. And, you know, Alzheimer's liberated her. And so all of a sudden, she started using words I didn't even know she'd heard, you know. But nothing about my background prepared me to be a social activist. What happened to me was that at age 14, I became pregnant through incest. This was not my choice. Older cousin who was supposed to be babysitting me decided to have sex with me. And this was back in the 1960s, so you didn't have a whole lot of options back then. I had no choice but to have the baby, and to hide me from the community and the neighborhood, my mother stuck me in what was called a home for unwed mothers back then. And so the plan was have the baby in secret, give him up for adoption, come back to my 10th grade life and act like nothing had happened. Which really worked for me very well, because becoming a mother through incest was not my plan at all. You know, I didn't like nothing about that scenario. But what happened was that the morning after my son was born, the nurses at the hospital made the mistake, as they probably do with all parents, that, you know, mothers that gave birth the night before, of bringing my son out with the rest of the babies that had been born the night before for nursing. And they didn't know my situation, so they put my son in my arms, and I kept looking at him saying, he's got my face. He's got my face. I mean, that's all I could, he's got my face. He's got my face. And they thought I'd lost my mind, but that's how your life can change. You know, literally how your life can change. So then I couldn't go through with the adoption. I hadn't even named my child because I hadn't planned on keeping him. So, you know, between he's got my face and them coming to take my baby, I had to find a name. I ended up naming him after two of my favorite brothers. I actually have five brothers, so I had a lot to choose from. I don't know what it said about the other three. But anyway, I ended up parenting that child, raising him. He's 40 years old now, and I'm really, really proud of him. He turned out to be a wonderful child, and I think the universe was kind to me because he gave me a, you know, I got a wonderful, easy to rear child that was not a real struggle. They figured his circumstances were a struggle. Don't make him a difficult child. Plus, my parents co-parented with me, like any other parents in that situation. Once I brought my son home, you would have thought it was their idea. You know, they got all over him. I mean, my mother pushed me to the side and acted like it was her ninth child. But it was wonderful, and that allowed me to finish high school. But the one thing that's important from that story is not only the sexual violence and the lack of reproductive choices that I had, but at the time, it was customary for schools to expel girls for being pregnant. I know, y'all say, no, that can't be. Anybody old enough to remember that? Raise your hands. I went through that. So then my parents and I had to sue my school system for the right to return to school. Because if I had had the abortion or given my baby up for adoption, then they could pretend that I had not been pregnant. And there would have been no problem. But the fact that I chose to keep my child meant that I was now vulnerable to being expelled from school. I mean, doesn't that kind of suck? And so we had to sue. They settled with us out of court. I was able to go back to school. But of course, going back to school with a baby in the 10th grade, when other people, by that time I'd gotten in 11th grade, you know, when other people were talking about going to proms and what college they were going to, and I was talking about, okay, I hope he doesn't wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning again so that I can get some sleep and all that, it changed my life. It, of course, matured me. And then even after I'd had that sexual experience, my mother would not sign the slip for me to access birth control. Again, I tell you, she's a Christian kind of woman. And so we had to struggle during my last remaining years of high school about my right to use birth control. And it went on and on and on. So needless to say, when it came time to go to college, I went to college as far away from her as I could get, which from Texas was Washington, D.C. And as I said, she wouldn't give me permission to get birth control. I was 16 at that time. So guess what happened to the girl who was suddenly free, who goes to college at 16? I got pregnant my freshman year in college. This time, fortunately, it was by my consent, meaning that at least the sex was consensual and stuff. And what was really, really fortunate for me was that Washington, D.C. was one of those few parts of the state that legalized abortion before Roe v. Wade. Okay, some states had done that. New York, Washington, D.C., a couple of states had done that. So my boyfriend at the time gladly paid for the abortion. He was in law school. He couldn't wait to pay for it. I still needed parental consent, though, because of course, if you can't get parental consent for birth control, how's a 16-year-old going to get an abortion? And so my mother would not sign the form. She would not sign the form. My mother had that kind of, you know, you made your bed, not lie in it kind of punitive Christian attitude. And she actually thought it would be a good idea if I dropped out of college and came home and raised however many kids I needed to have. And I was pregnant with twins, too, so she thought it was a sign from God. Fortunately, I have an older sister named Carol, who's 9 years older than me, and Carol ended up forging my mother's signature to the permission slip. So I was able to go to a hospital, have what would be called now a late-term abortion, because I was at the end of my second trimester by the time I worked all of the details out. So I had a saline abortion. I don't know if you're familiar with that procedure where they inject this long needle into your abdomen and cause you to go into labor. And I witnessed the birth or the non-birth of my two fetuses and stuff. And I have to honestly say, I have no regrets about that. Because if parenting one child at 16 was hard, parenting three would have been a nightmare. I mean, just these are the choices that women make. And so I've been on a lot of right-wing talk shows that, you know, challenge me to why I support abortion rights, because I'm one of those people that say, I'm way beyond pro-choice. I am pro-abortion. And I say that proudly because I know it saves my life and it saves the lives of women. So I make no apologies for that. And so I get on these right-wing talk shows and they say, well, you know, you've had an abortion and, you know, you're so happy with your son, and if you'd aborted him, you know, look at all the joy you would have missed and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's always, you know, men often who wax poetic about the joy of parenting. I haven't seen them have a period yet. But anyway, and they don't understand that how could I have the child I had out of incest and then abort the children I had out of a committed relationship? You know, for them that's like a little confusing because it doesn't fit the script. But they don't understand that every woman makes the decisions that's right for her at the time she makes that decision. There's no formula. You know, if the child is born of rape, you have to have an abortion. If the child is born of love, you have to have the baby. It does not work that neatly or cleanly. And so I have a lot of fun confounding them with the reality of my life and letting them understand that, oh, you talk about, well, you can have the baby and give him up for adoption. Let me tell you how that ain't that easy. You know, this adoption myth that you're running out here, that, you know, you just give the baby up for adoption, forget about it, get back to your life and we'll raise your happy baby. Nothing about a pregnancy is easy. You can embrace it with joy or you can embrace it with fear, like I was dealing with. But that don't make it easy. And so, anyway, oh, just to put the end to the personal story, because you're gonna bring me up here for my sad story, is that a few years later, I accepted a long-term contraceptive called the Dalcon Shield, which was an IUD, an intrauterine device, because I was what they call a bad contraceptor. I, you know, hated pills. They made me sick. You know, I had real difficulties persuading my boyfriend to use condoms. You know, there was a real risk that I would get pregnant again. And so I accepted this Dalcon Shield, and it ended up sterilizing me. And it ruptured my fallopian tubes. I had to have a total hysterectomy after I went into coma to save my life. And so that was my reproductive career, a birth, an abortion, and a sterilization. And that happened over like a brief 7-year period. So I have been pissed off ever since. Let's put it that way. Yeah. And even though, you know, I'm well over 50 and knocking on Social Security doors, I never forget how scared that 14-year-old girl was and the different things I had to do to survive for me and my child and the hard choices that I had to make. And so people ask, well, where do you find the energy for this movement to stay in it for 35, 40 years? I'm like, hell, all I have to do is flip through the film of my life. And I can always find passion for working to make sure that what happened to me doesn't happen to other women. This isn't some intellectual pursuit. This is the car, you know, you what they say, you play the hands that you're dealt. That's all I could do. And that's where my passion for this work comes from. Now, I'm telling you this story not only because you changed my life in making me change my speech, but I want each of you doing this work, find your story and start telling it. Don't say, I do this work because I care for those women over here. You know, that's the missionary approach. Do this work because you've had sexual experiences, that you've had your choices either upheld or denied. Either one will work. I mean, I'm not saying that we want to get into competing traumas, because I like hearing the stories of women who escape childhood without sexual abuse. I like hearing the stories of people who chose to be pregnant and chose the way that they were going to have those babies. I didn't have that experience, so it's always wonderful for me to hear that. So I'm not saying tell your story and let's all start crying together. It is not about that. I'm saying your story is your fuel and your passion, and it's your authenticity. You know? And it's your story. Nobody gets to judge your story. Nobody gets to say, well, you should have done, you should have. You know, it's not that. So if you want to do this work in a transformative way, start by telling your stories, either in small groups or in large groups, however you need to do it. This phallic thing. I feel like I have a penis up here jumping up. Which is really bad for an oversexed woman. So. Can't do anything about it. Huh? Well, you gotta watch, you know, us raunchy girls. Anyway, so that's my introduction. You know, and that's why the play last night, I almost couldn't sit through it. Because I remember needing Jane and there not being one in Texas. I remember being in that home for unwed mothers and trying to hide a pregnancy from an entire community. I remember those days. And so watching the Janes play last night, I've actually interviewed a lot of members of the Jane Collective and wrote about them in some of my writings, like Dolores Nolan, who Denise played, was the black woman who was one of the founders of the collective, and Laura Kaplan and I are good friends who wrote the story of Jane and stuff. And so I've kind of distanced myself, because you know, you deal with these materials all the time. But last night brought me back to being 14, 15 years old again. So thank you. Thank you. It really refreshed me in a way I wasn't really planning on it. When, you know, Simon and Jane were saying, you want to go to this play? I was like, oh, shit. They just told me I had to give a couple of speeches. They didn't say I needed to hang out watching bad acting. You know, that was going through my mind. To be honest, you know. You know how it is when people invite you to slam poetry and you pretend you like it? I mean, you know. But I'm so glad I did. And it had helped me challenge my own arrogance, which is something that all of us occasionally need, and probably me more than anybody else. The other thing I want to say that this conference transformed me on is that I was in Ireland a couple of months ago with the Irish Family Planning Association. I am astonished at how the reproductive justice framework is being picked up around the world. It's not something that we who created it planned on. We thought it was just going to be something that only applied to the United States, that was only useful in the United States. And so from Peru to Brazil to Ireland, I mean, now I'm looking at maybe Sister Song needs to go global or something. This is not what we had planned on, but we're not going to say no. But the trip to Ireland was again useful for me because it showed me a group of women who had it even worse than the women I was dealing with. You know, because no matter how bad you think your situation is, you can always find somebody who has it worse. And I don't think I was expecting it in Ireland, though. And watching the women do abortion tourism, I guess to call it, to be denied their rights, to not even be seen as human beings. I mean, we in the States are always envious of Canada, and now I see Ireland as envious of the States, and we're like, you know, we are being screwed without a kiss everywhere. Whew! So thank you for your presentation on explaining what I couldn't quite understand about the Irish laws and the European Court of Human Rights. I was just there telling about reproductive justice. I did not know the background fabric of what I was in the context of. So thank you, too. So let's get to work. First of all, what I'm going to do today, and I've taken entirely too much time doing that already, is give you some background on Sister Song, our collective. We have a sign-in sheet going around. Simon, is that still going around? If you haven't signed the sign-in sheet, hold your hand up, because we want to add you all to our mailing list, okay? We want to encourage you all to join Sister Song. Membership in Sister Song is open to everybody who has a radical analysis about what we need for women. Okay, even though it was founded by women of color, like our analysis, is not only for women of color, it's really the home for those of us who think the phrase choice is great, but doesn't necessarily contain all that we want to talk about in terms of what women's human rights are. I mean, you can have bad choices and still have choices. Yeah, so that's what we are. We also have our newsletter on the table out there, Collective Voices. I do not want to take those heavy newsletters home, so take as many as you want, and I'll distribute the rest of them tonight. Now, we created the concept of reproductive justice because, as I said, as women of color, by the way, do y'all know the origin of the term women of color? Let me give a little history lesson. In 1977, as part of the World Decade for Women, President Jimmy Carter gave the women's movement $5 million. Can you imagine that? And we had our own U.S. Women's Conference as a counterpart to the World Conferences for Women that were taking place, Mexico City, Copenhagen, Beijing, Nairobi, et cetera, et cetera. And so they prepared this plan of action, they meaning leading feminists like Bella Abzug and Eleanor Smeal and Gloria Steinem, had prepared this plan of action for what U.S. women wanted. And they had created this document within the plan of action called the Minority Women's Plank, which was, you know, in a 200-something page plan of action was all of one page. And, I mean, they did their best effort. These are all friends of mine, or until Bella died. But anyway, a group of black women in D.C. said, excuse me, but our hopes and dreams can't be contained in one short page. And so they created what they called the Black Women's Action Plan that they wanted to substitute for the Minority Women's Plank in the full action plan. Have y'all followed me so far? I'm not sure if I'm making sense. Okay. And a strange thing happened in Houston, where the conference was in 1977. When they got there, the Black Women's Action Plan proved so popular to other minority women that they wanted to sign on to it. And so obviously if the Native American women, if the Latinas, if the Asian Pacific Islander women joined the minority women, the Black Women's Action Plan, it wasn't gonna be just the Black Women's Action Plan anymore. And so in their deliberations in Houston, they created the term women of color to talk about not biological designations, I mean, you're born, whatever biology says you're born, but to talk about political solidarity of oppressed women working together. And so that's where the term women of color came from, 1977 Houston Conference. And so if you ever, and then what strange things happen, because so many times women of color hear the term from white women, they think white women created it, you know, which is kind of ironic. And they say, I'm not a woman of color, I'm not colored. Well, I guess you aren't, honey. Because you don't have the political understanding of what it means to work in solidarity with other oppressed women. Okay? So that's just a little history lesson. I'm good for history lessons. When you've been around as long as I am, you were there when most of this shit happened. So I'm good for history. Okay, so in 1994, a group of black women, I guess we always take ourselves and put ourselves in this position, were debating health care reform with President Clinton's administration. And kind of like the Obama administration, the Clintons had decided that they would get health care reform passed if they had no mention of abortion in it. Didn't work, did it? And it's not working now. President, are you paying attention? Anyway, and so we were meet a group of black women representing all different organizations. I wasn't even working at a women's organization at the time. I was working at my anti-Klan, anti-fascist group. Anyway, we were meeting in this hotel talking about how pissed off we were about the healthcare reform process. And we decided to publish a signature ad in the Washington Post protesting the omission of abortion coverage in healthcare reform, because we knew what a bad impact it would have on black women if this happened. And then we were searching for a name to call ourselves. And we thought about, some of us were from the state, some of us were from the diaspora and stuff. So we called ourselves Women of African Descent, which is kind of bad because we would have been known as Wadis if that name had stuck. But Women of African Descent for Reproductive Justice. And the term reproductive justice was created because we felt that there was something acutely wrong in isolating abortion from all the other social justice issues out there. Because every time a woman is pregnant, oh my God, she doesn't even have to be pregnant. Every time a woman misses a period, she starts having what we call the oh my God moments. Oh my God, what am I gonna do? Oh my God. Who am I going to tell? Oh, my God, will I get fired? Oh, my God, what's mama going to say? Oh, my God, what's my partner going to say? Oh, my God, will I get beaten? I mean, these oh, my God conversations are the human rights issues that preface any decision about whether or not to have the baby or not. As a matter of fact, the answer to the oh, my God questions will determine whether you keep the pregnancy or not. Isn't that how it really works, folks? You know, it's not like, oh, I'm pregnant, let me decide what I'm going to do. Anybody who bleed ain't had that one yet. And anybody who bleeds, let that sucker be late. How many of us have had oh my God conversations? Tell me about it, right? Because that's all it takes. A couple of days late and you're like, oh shit. Right? That's the real life of women. Not this mythical one the pro-choice, the pro-life divide talks about. So we decided to take the term reproductive rights and marry it to the term social justice. And that's where the term reproductive justice came from, the embedding of abortion rights in a social justice context. To answer those questions of, how come women don't have economic security? Why don't they have health care? Why aren't they free from violence? Why don't we have enough bedrooms for our child? Why don't we have safe schools and safe environments? All those things that determine whether or not you're going to carry a pregnancy to term or not. And so that's where the term came from. It has since evolved. We had also got engaged in the international conferences and the International Conference on Population and Development in 1994 in Cairo, Egypt, showed us that the rest of the world was using the human rights framework to lay claim to the same things we were defining as social justice issues. And they were so far ahead of us than we were in the States that we decided to embrace the human rights framework and use that as the foundation for our activism. So 3 years later, when Sister Song was founded in 1997 by 16 women of color organizations, you heard me say that in the film, try not to repeat that, we decided that we were going to take a human rights approach to our work and we would use reproductive justice as our central organizing framework, which turns out to be a good decision, basically. And it is based on human rights. Many of us use the concept of human rights without properly understanding it, but it starts from our conviction that every woman, and really every human being, because we are now looking at gender identity and whether or not we need to just be talking about women, but every human being has the right to have a child, to not have a child, and to parent the children they have. It's that simple. So Sister Song is a pro-choice organization with pro-life people in our ranks. So we're a little weird hybrid that way, because we have it all right within our ranks. And we're proud of that. We're actually proud of that. Because we take a much more realistic view of saving women's lives and fighting for women's rights in such a way that the pro-choice, pro-life divide means nothing to us. You know, now, of course, we don't embrace the crazies on either side, but particularly the ones, you know, I get a lot of dead fetus pictures at home because, you know, I'm out so much. You know, used to when I could do anti-Klan work or abortion rights work, I could hide, you know, it's in the safety of my home and kind of separate my work from my safe, from my home space. Google changed all of that. Now you have to, all you have to do is Google me and you can find out where I live. So at any day I expect a bullet through a window. I mean, I've got anti-Klan, I've got Klan enemies, Nazi enemies, abortion enemies, I mean, you know. And then I probably have just pissed some people off by being a bitch, so. You know. But anyway, when we learned about using the human rights framework, that became very important to us. So I want to really emphasize that when you talk about reproductive justice, you have to, for us, you have to use the human rights framework. It is a framework of intersectionality, yes. But intersectionality is a process. Your end goal is the achievement of full human rights. And to get there, you have to intersect people's identities. And so the ability of any human being to make decisions about his or her life is always related to which community in which you're embedded and which human rights violations you're experiencing or which human rights you are enjoying. So that's why we say often, even though it was a framework created by women of color, it ain't just for women of color, unless you're one of those people walking around with only one identity. You know, everybody is a walking coalition, you know, able to care about more than one issue at a time. And so that's why I'm so passionate that we're the women's wing of the human rights movement. You know, and let's stop isolating our issue, abortion, from all the other human rights issues out there. And as a matter of fact, let me clean up something, because one thing that we frequently encounter in advocating for abortion as a human right is opponents to abortion rights who misuse the human rights framework trying to claim human rights for the unborn or the preborn or whatever they want to call them. And it is a misuse of the framework. As a matter of fact, basic human rights 101 education, if they bother to get there, would tell them that the very first paragraph of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written in 1948, by the way, long before this whole fight over abortion rights erupted, the very first paragraph says, all human beings are born equal in rights and dignity. Guess what? You have to be born to claim the rights. It doesn't say are thought of in the future, our swimming little spermatozoa. It basically says you have to be born to lay claim to those human rights. And so they take advantage of our lack of familiarity with the human rights framework to confuse us over whether or not there's a contest between the human rights of the unborn and the human rights of people already here. But the Declaration has solved that question for us. You have to be born to claim the rights. It's just as simple. Now, the religions sometimes get confused. Oh, speaking of religions, I want to recommend a wonderful book. I'm no scholar. I'm an activist that pretends to be a scholar. But I had a chance and was recommended a book called The World Lit Only by Fire. The World Lit Only by Fire by this professor named William Masterson. And why would I be recommending this book? Because it ain't a feminist book. It ain't written for, and it's a historical treatment of the Dark Ages and medieval Europe. So so why would I be bringing that in? Like the Da Vinci Code, why would I be bringing that in? What Professor Masterson does masterfully is in a novel in an approach written like a novel, he explains the anti-intellectual and anti-science biases of the Catholic Church and how they originated in the Dark Ages and why they so desperately cling to anti-modernity, anti-science, and anti-intellectualism today. And the corruption of the priests and the father and the children that they fathered, the sexual abuse of the nuns, by the nuns, everybody was screwing everybody in the Catholic Church. And they were mostly exploiting the people they were supposed to serve. And they concretized, like in the 6th century, a commitment to fighting science, modernity, enlightenment, knowledge, because they can only maintain power through fear. And they realized this in the 6th century and wrote it out. And I'm like, oh shit. These folks been doing this for a long, long time, so why are we surprised they are so fundamentally opposed to women's human rights? But I'm also portraying only the extreme right wing of the Catholic Church, which is the dominant wing. So we should not paint it all with one brush, however that saying goes. Because there's a left wing of the Catholic Church, the liberation theology wing. I've seen Catholic nuns perform abortions in the Philippines. So there's a left wing, a center, and a right wing of this institution I'm calling the Catholic Church. So I'm talking about the Opus Dei wing of the church. Unfortunately, they're the dominant wing right now that we're having to deal with. So The World Lit Only by Fire by William Masterson, I really recommend it. So I want to use my last few minutes talking about black abortion, because that's actually why you brought me up here. And let's see, where would I want to start with this? It would help if I had a speech, right? Sorry. Y'all kept reinventing it. Well, let me talk to them. I'm an expert on black abortion. I can claim that. I did not start out to be an expert on black abortion. I only had one, and I swear I faint every time I see the forceps or a speculum, so I'm not necessarily a provider. I don't do blood well, except on a football field. Anyway, in 1985, I was working for the National Organization for Women, NOW, and my boss, Ellie Smeal, came to me and said, Loretta, we're getting ready to organize a march for abortion rights. And your job is to go out there and organize women of color to support this march. And I looked at Ellie like she'd lost her mind. I was like, Ellie, my community is still set calling it the A word. Now, you want me to not only get them to say the full word abortion, but march for it too? I mean, I just thought it was an impossible task. And I hate when your bosses give you things that look like they're going to fail, because no matter what you do, you're going to look like a fool. And so I said, okay, I still want a paycheck. I do believe in the cause, but this is really hard. Because only one black women's organization, the National Political Congress of Black Women at that time, had taken an openly pro-choice stance. Even the National Council of Negro Women, which is much older, had tepidly supported abortion rights, but they hadn't come out like in any big public way and said that they were pro-choice or anything. And so I'm like, I gotta go talk to the sororities and the churches, and oh my God, this was my oh my God moment. And anyway, so I started going around and talking to them, and they said, Loretta, we're with you, but our base wouldn't like that. They don't want us to get in that kind of controversial issue. Now, wait a moment. When black women's organizations start avoiding controversy, something's wrong. By definition, they're controversial in a white supremacist country. So, you know, it wasn't working. So what I finally realized is that a considerable history around Black women's activism in protecting our self-determination and our bodies was not known to the Black women's activists I was talking to. Because I knew, you know, roughly, that we had fought the enslavement of our people. We had fought the forced breeding of our people. But there was no connect. So I started doing research and I started writing what's now called Black Abortion on the history of Black women's activism. Not what was done to us, but what we did for ourselves. And I discovered abortion formula that go all the way back to Egyptian papyruses. So we bought over from Africa a lot of knowledge of using herbs and potions and physical manipulation to both prevent a pregnancy and to terminate one. And in fact, I found that during the enslavement process, whole plantations of women didn't have babies. And the reason we know this is because the plantation owners brought in doctors to do medical exams to figure out why whole plantations of women who were having all this sex weren't having babies. And so it's through those medical reports we're finding out that women bought from Africa indigenous knowledge on how to control their fertility. And only as they became Christianized did they determine that this knowledge was a sin. You know? And so, anyway, I started writing Black Abortion. So what that has made me is somewhat knowledgeable about how to deal with these people who claim Black abortion is genocide. And I think that was part of the reason I was invited to come talk today. Frankly, most of the people who parrot this perception are apologists for sexism, number one, often being very cynically used and rewarded by conservative forces who have a larger agenda that has nothing to do with saving Black babies, and really can be foisted upon unsuspecting groups and campuses because we got a whole set of white people who are uncomfortable with talking about racism and white supremacy. So, you know, it's kind of like the perfect storm comes together. And the next thing you know, everybody's confused. Well, I can say that as Black women, we know that abortion is not slavery. Abortion is not genocide. Lack of abortion is slavery. When you are forced to carry a pregnancy to term against your will, that's the use of your body for somebody else. That's what's called slavery. And so those who would preach that are really preaching the re-enslavement of Black women. Which we go like, oh, hell no. It does not make sense. And I actually think that if we argued for abortion rights as a violation of the human right to resist slavery, we would actually get a lot further. Because no human being should be allowed to submit their body for the use of another human being. That's slavery. No, there's no way, you know, it's not ambiguous at all. So basically what people are arguing is that when a woman gets pregnant, she is reduced to the status of a slave. And that's supposed to be okay? So that's not one. Not only that, but what you find when you peel back people like the Genocide Awareness Project or Project LEARN or all of these fronts for the white anti-abortion movement, that they have an agenda that is very much rooted in supporting an anti-human rights agenda. So they're against gay rights, of course. I mean, that's an easy one for them. Matter of fact, when Operation Rescue, or now known as Operation Save America, came to demonstrate down in Atlanta, they were trying to like assume the mantle of Dr. Martin Luther King, and his niece, Dr. King's niece, Alveda King, is like one of their leading proponents, which of course confuses people because they hear the word King and they think that, you know, it's okay. He's got, to, you know, this is one of the members of the King family. So, you know, I'm confused. They have no idea how dysfunctional that King family is. But anyway, well, when they came to Atlanta, on one weekend, they demonstrated against our gay pride weekend, and then the next weekend, they demonstrated against black abortion. We thought that was awfully convenient, because then we could show the Atlanta community that they had a united agenda against human rights. You know, and that was very important to point out. But they're against public education. Now, why would black people be against public education? It's the only thing that lifted us out of the ignorance of enslavement. I mean, when you look at their full agenda, it just does not make sense. And then, like, one thing that the conservative forces are adept at doing is finding these tokens that they can prop up and create the appearance that they're actually a multiracial movement. And so they'll find one black person to be a teabagger. You know, one black person who's, you know, opposed to black women. One black person. You know, they always do that. Now, the question isn't why they always do it. The question is, why do we always fall for it? Because this is not a novel or new tactic. They've been doing this for 400 years. I bet you they find the one indigenous person who doesn't think treaties should be supported. I mean, you know, this is how divide and conquer works. And there's nothing original about that. What I am a little tired of is us falling for it. And so I've written so much on the black anti-abortion movement. I actually have a paper here. Did I send it to you, Jane? Yeah, I have so many papers on this, and I'd be more than happy to share them with you. Jane has some of them. You can Google them and stuff like that. So I really don't need to go, I hope I don't need to go that much further into explaining how wrong they are and how we need to resist them. First of all, they're not that much interested in the welfare of the child once the child is here, or they'd be fighting with us for breakfast programs and health care and safe schools and environmental justice and all the things that we're fighting for. They're trying to pretend that they're only doing this to save black women, but frankly, the black women that need to be saved are the black women who are being battered and beaten by the assholes called black men who think violating black women is a way to liberation. I hope I said that right. Yeah. I call it not the backlash, but the blacklash. And so I've been following them for a while. I've definitely end up in a lot of their newspapers talking about what a genocide. Oh, the last thing I want to say about the genocide argument is that it's not only sexist and deeply racist, it's also deeply anti-Semitic. Because to compare black people exercising bodily self-determination over our bodies in general and comparing black women in particular to Nazis, diminishes the suffering of the millions of people who the Nazis did exterminate, primarily Jewish people. So you trivialize the Holocaust in your attempt to violate us. And we're supposed to just take that and support you in that? It's sexist, it's racist, and it's anti-Semitic, and we don't want any parts of it. And so, don't be confused. In 1992, thousands of us signed a petition called We Remember. We Remember is a very important petition. It's in many of our books. I think it's in Marlene Freed's book, From Abortion to Reproductive Freedom. It was a statement written by black women, and we had like 600 black women come together to write a statement firmly in support of abortion rights. And we called it We Remember because we remember forced breeding. we ain't gonna never forget forced breeding, no more than a Jewish person is gonna forget the Holocaust. Because for us, that is the genocide. To be have our bodies not in our control, to benefit a capitalist system. We've been there before. That ain't original either. And so I invite you to look up this history, know that history, and know how we have to become adept at having discourse on race and white supremacy so that they can't continue to confuse us in the future. So that we know what to call racist and what not to call racist. And I think that starts with having more conversations with people of color, you know, having these conversations, but also accepting that white supremacy is not a skin color, it's a set of ideas. Okay, you don't have to be white to have white supremacist ideas. And everybody white ain't white supremacist. So get over the confusion. You know, it's a set of ideas. It's not how you're born. It's the choices you make. You know? So anyway, let me shut up and thank y'all for listening to me. And let me see if I have any questions before I get off this stage. Thank you. I think I have like roughly 2-3 minutes for questions max. And I guess there were no questions. I did such a complete job. Are you just scared of me because I used curse words or something? I never promised to keep it clean, and it is so hard for me to give speeches in front of religious people because I feel like I have to self-censor all the great words that I know. And because my mother wouldn't let me curse, I deliberately do it all the time.
Can you tell people what the Sister Song motto is?
Oh, what the Sister... She said, can I tell people what the Sister Song motto is? And I should go back closing about Sister Song. Our motto is, we do collectively what we can't do individually. Our name, Sister Song, was born out of the realization that we were sitting around at this meeting talking about how bad things are in our communities, you know, no health care, midwives have, you know, being prosecuted and, you know, bad sex education, you know, which is even worse than bad sex. Anyway, and one of our founders, Juanita Williams, who's a grandmother surviving HIV/AIDS, she said, you know, we're all singing the same song. We need to learn how to sing our songs in harmony with each other. And so there our name was born, Sister Song. We're not a singing group. We're a group of women of color doing our own individual work who come together for strength to do collectively what we can't do individually. We are not a group thinker, meaning that, like I said, we have some of our founders are pro-lifers. You know, so they didn't get added in later. They were there at the beginning. So it's in our DNA to maintain and treasure our diversity of race, ethnicity, community, and thinking while working together to achieve unprecedented things. And so that's what Sister Song is. We have a lot of joy. And then in 2003, we added white women. And then in 2004, we added Arab American, Middle Eastern, and that same year we added men. So now Sister Song is everybody. But it started out that way. And that's what, oh, and I do need to do a commercial because I want y'all all to become members so that you can get the member discounts to our next conference, which is gonna be quite exciting because it's called, come on, Jessica. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's do We do have these sex conferences. And the reason we have them is because we're in communities, as I said on the film, where the failure to talk about sex is killing us. And so our next Let's Talk About Sex conference is going to be in July 2011 in Miami. Sex on the beach sounds like a good idea to us. And I've just recently learned that there's a drink called Sex on the Beach. You want to talk about how, like, unaware I am. But we're going to have Sex on the Beach in Miami in 2011. We invite all of you to send delegations, come to the conference, offer to do workshops. Some of the work y'all are doing, we need to know about. you know, teach us, help us to have this shared learning experience and stuff. We offer some special scholarships to everything we do at Sister Song, and they're called mother-daughter scholarships. So if the mother or the daughter is registered, then you can get a scholarship to bring the other. So that these conversations about sex happen within families. And they call them mother-daughter scholarships, but they're any family relationship will do. So, you know, father-daughter, you know, niece, uncle, it doesn't matter. They're just called the mother-daughter scholarship. Because we think having these conversations about healthy, safe sex is so important within families and within generations. And so we have indigenous scholarships, and these are all different scholarship pools that don't compete. So we have scholarships for indigenous people, we have scholarships for young people, we have mother-daughter scholarships, and then we also have a general scholarship pool. And we give away a lot of scholarships, but you do have to be a member to qualify. And so probably within the next 90 days, and particularly that's why I want y'all to sign that sign-in list so y'all get the first notification of when the website will be open for registration for Let's Talk About Sex. And I want to see y'all on, bring your funky, sexy, raunchy selves. This is not the clinical discussion that you got in sex ed or biology class. This is a conference about, okay, let me close by saying, the genesis for this conference was the Pro-Choice Education Project did a survey of Latina and African-American youth. And one of the questions that kept coming up in their survey, and this was in 2003, I think it was, 2004, was that every young person they surveyed basically said, everybody's telling us what not to do. Who's telling us what to do? You know, everybody's just saying no. But what do we say yes to? You know, we're human beings, we're sexual beings, but where do we have those conversations? And so when I got that survey and we were at a Sister Song board meeting, I started talking about what this survey was telling us. And our board in that moment decided, well, we can provide a space where they can talk about what they should be saying yes to. Yeah, let's provide a space to talk about sex. And so that's how the conference was born. We got a lot of flack for calling it a sex conference, because everybody thought we were suddenly an arm of the pornography movement, like they need our help. But it's worked real well. We do have to restrict the age to 13, though, 13 and above. It's an arbitrary number. If somebody 11 showed up with a parent, we probably wouldn't put them out or anything. But I have to say that all of our workshops are frank and honest. As a matter of fact, the workshop tracks are before sex, during sex, and after sex. What do you need to know? Thank y'all.